Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute. I do not own a JAG. Welcome to another lecture at Einstein Fest. Great, as always, to see so many familiar faces. There are some people who are insatiable, and that's just great. There are a few people I think I have seen at every single lecture in this festival. So welcome. We are delighted tonight to welcome Stanley Korngold as our lecturer. Stanley Korngold graduated from Columbia and Cornell Universities and has been professor of German and comparative literature at Princeton since 1981. He has published on the intersections of literature and theory, most recently in books on Franz Kafka and German aesthetics. His research interests center on topics in German literary and intellectual history, such as philosophical aesthetics in the age of Goethe, and lyric poetry at the turn of the 20th century. He has translated and edited a new Norton critical edition of Kafka's selected stories due out this year, and is at work on a volume entitled Kafka Before the Law, which will relate Kafka's official writings as an executive in workman's compensation insurance to his stories and novels. His most recent book is Lambent Traces, Franz Kafka. Some of his recent articles deal with Hegel's aesthetics, the figure of Zarathustra in Nietzsche and Kafka, the Great War and modern German memory, the phenomenology of email, the discourse of bookkeeping in modernist literature, Kafka and music, cannibalism in Hegel and Schopenhauer, and translation as the enemy of comparative literature. We are honored to have him with us tonight. Please welcome Stanley Korngold.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm wired, and I hope it'll all make sense. And I hope you'll hear me properly, and I hope you'll signal if you don't. Thanks for the warm welcome. Delighted to be here. Delighted to see you. The literature produced by European writers in the years around 1905 is of extraordinary quality. This very productivity arises very likely from resistance to the new forms of modern life, to the frantic pace of Central European modernization, the rapid growth in the manufacture of commodities based on the introduction of labor-saving machinery, and around 1911, on the principles of so-called scientific management. In America, we know that as the Taylor speed-up system. Accompanying this frenzy of production is a correspondingly rapid circulation of goods by motor vehicles and railways, and of incentives to acquire goods by advertisements, billboards, flyers. The acquisition of wealth and its concentration, together with populations of workers and managers in great cities, produces changes in class structure, including the emergence of a middle class, bent less on adventure than on accumulating and preserving wealth. These developments required and produced rapid innovation in the means of communication, for cities are centers of simultaneous but dissociated activity. In a word, new media, typewriter, telephone, telegraph. Now, all these changes are greeted by some writers at around 1905 as matters of great intellectual interest. By the best of them, however, as signs of the pathological breakdown of older norms and values. William Butler Yeats, the great contemporary Irish poet, contemporary of 1905, addressed this situation negatively. Quote, "Our thought, because it needs leisure, is rural like all ancient art. Modern civilization, created by industrialism, has been a violent interruption." Among the poets whom Yeats specifically named as part of a resistant classical tradition were the German poets Rainer Maria Rilke and Stefan George, the latter regarded by many as the most important German language poet of the last century. This same Stefan George, whose background was Catholic and rural, wrote in an important preface to his journal, Pages on Art, Letter für die Kunst, quote, this journal aims at an emancipation. The spiritual source of this misery is the Protestant Reformation, which prepared the ground for liberalism, capitalism, and modernism. And he means by the latter word, modernism, artistic movements reproducing, both in content and style, the often deformed products of this urban interruption. Modernization involves, of course, a leveling out of persons and things so as to make them countable. With such developments, there emerges a non-tragic view of life, where suggestions of death and loss in everyday life are minimized by their ease of replacement, and where such broken things as cannot be made good are confined away, out of sight and hearing, in public hospitals, mean streets, and asylums. Rilke, for one, begins his great work, The Notebooks of Malte Lorenz Brügge, which is the name of the hero, he's a Dane, published in 1910 but begun in 1904, begins by evoking the impersonality of dying and death in Paris. On the very first page of this fictional memoir, headed amazingly enough with the date September 11th, the narrator writes, quote, so this is where people come to live. I would have thought it is a city to die in. I have been out. I saw hospitals. In this one, there are 559 beds to die in. Like a factory, of course, with production so enormous, each individual death is not made very carefully, but that isn't important. It's the quantity that counts. Who is there and still cares about a well-finished death? None. Even the rich, who could, after all, afford this luxury, are beginning to grow lazy and indifferent. The desire to have a death of one's own is becoming more and more rare. In a short time, it will be as rare as a life of one's own. Against this leveling thrust, there arises, unlike the commodity, the unique, lifelike literary work of art. Typically, in his journal, Pages on Art, you remember, Blätter für die Kunst, George writes, citing the Dutch poet Verweij, quote, only when the movement of life becomes measured in words does it attain its highest power. And indeed, this sanctification of poetic language is the crux of poetic resistance at this time. Kafka, for one, wrote that he had been en route to composing a new Kabbalah had he not been interrupted in another sense by the politics of Zionism. The poetic word arises, in part, from a spirit of resistance to what we can call the fungibility of language under the sign of modernity. Fungibility is a term normally used to define commodities, where, as the definition runs, one part or quantity may be replaced by another equal part or quantity in satisfying an obligation. If you deal in such things as George's handwritten poems, he wrote them in a very special hand, if you deal in such things and the ship you are shipping them in sinks, you cannot replace them. If sacks of cocoa beans or hog bellies sink, you can replace them. The loss can be made good. The bookkeeper can balance his books. But great writers like Rilke and André Gide and Robert Musil and Hermann Broch, all writers at this time, who, as I shall show, were curiously fascinated by the figure of bookkeeping, are bent on concluding that persons and desires cannot be made equivalent by such calculations. Now, we're concerned with the literature published around this year, 1905. But for a hint as to its principles, I'll jump ahead one decade to 1914 and quote from a great work of reflective criticism by the philosopher Georg Lukács, titled Theory of the Novel. This long essay states its topic at the outset, quote, the forms of great epic literature are examined in relation to whether the general civilization of the time is an integrated or a problematic one. The civilization that Lukács and the world inherited in the first decade of the 20th century had long ceased to be an integrated one. It was a problematic one. Consider Lukács' sense of what an integrated civilization might be. The ideal of an outer world in such a civilization, he writes, is the starry sky, luminous, brilliant, patterned. Imagine, if you will, standing in a world of things by which you feel as sheltered and thrilled as by the starry sky, a world in which all things are constellated. Happy are those ages, he writes, and he's thinking of Greece, when the starry sky is the map of all possible paths, ages whose paths are illuminated by the light of the stars. Everything in such ages is new and yet familiar, full of adventure and yet their own. The world is wide, and yet it is like a home, for the fire that burns in the soul is of the same essential nature as the stars. The world and the self, the light and the fire, are sharply distinct, yet they never become permanent strangers to one another. For fire is the soul of all light, and all fire clothes itself in light. It's a very famous passage that we have our students study. Baudelaire, the great French poet of the previous generation, whom George translated and Rilke quoted at length in his novel Malte Lorenz-Brügge, conjures such a world, an integrated world, in his poem Correspondance. This is how Correspondance begins. Nature is a temple where living pillars sometimes let emerge confused words. Man crosses it through forests of symbols which watch him with intimate eyes. Like those deep echoes that meet from afar in a dark and profound harmony, as vast as night and clarity, so perfumes, colors, tones respond to each other. In such an integrated civilization, Lukács continues, each action of the soul becomes meaningful and rounded in this duality, complete in meaning, in sense, and complete for the senses, rounded, because the soul rests within itself even while it acts, rounded, because its action separates itself from it, and having become itself, finds a center of its own and draws a closed circumference round itself. Philosophy, he says, he quotes, and the romantic poet Novalis, philosophy is really homesickness. It is the urge to be at home everywhere. As I read this translation, I notice that the word rounded keeps occurring. That could seem odd. It's the German rund, which means whole. Here, philosophy is defined as nostalgia, as the thrust of the human spirit aiming to recapture a lost unity, to secure a foundation, to put things to right in its own home. We are, on the other hand, are concerned with literature. And in the period we're looking at, great literature is actually at war with such philosophy. Being less haunted by the urge to be at home everywhere, than it is militantly determined to preserve its own exile and give the fullest account of its alienation from any home whatsoever. And it rather pridefully contents itself with this beautiful statement of a sense of eternal separation. One of our main authors, Robert Musil, puts this mood in this way, at the time of justifying, indeed jubilantly welcoming, Germany's entrance into the Great War. The date of composition is exactly the same as that of Lukács' theory of the novel, from which I just read a passage. Musil celebrates the coming of the war on the strength of a new set of virtues allegedly alive in the nation. Virtues unknown, he writes, to the art and imagination of German literature in around 1905. These new virtues, which are different, are the sorts of virtues once alive in Lukács' integrated civilization, namely loyalty, courage, subordination, simplicity. These are the words of Musil. But the fact that these qualities went unmentioned in modernist literature around 1905 was not entirely our fault, continues Musil. After all, we did not know then, at the beginning of the century, what a beautiful and fraternal thing war is. And yet, in another sense, continues Musil, the literature of modernity was not fundamentally different from this new culture of war, for it was always in opposition. Its goal, after all, was always, quote, to bend and expose traditional, established, and dependable psychological attitudes en route to puncturing them. And now that this old aggression informing artistic criticism has surfaced, this is Musil, we realize that our culture has always been inspired by the same martial and conquering spirit that we feel today in its primordial form in us and around us, astonishing and transporting us with happiness. This is a side look into the exaltation and hysteria that greeted Germany's entrance into the war in 1914 and was on the lips of many of its great writers. The point here, though, is that he shows us, claims literature was always militantly opposed, and hence is different from the philosophy that Lukács discussed as longing always for a home. Musil sees in a literature of exile and alienation something defiant, something martial. And I've put this resistance of this modern literature in two ways so far. It opposes the fungibility of the words of experience. It opposes commonplaces and stereotypes. And hence, it opposes the loss of the unique life, for each work of literature is or strives to be this unique being. And secondly, within its form, it opposes, quote, traditional, established, and dependable psychological attitudes, that's Musil's phrase, including the easily absorbed attitude of nostalgia for a lost paradise. This is the place to insist on the courage of this oppositional spirit, which must continually resist the lure of specious harmonies. Nietzsche instances the patronage of princes, fame, and the love of beautiful women, all to be resisted. Even as the spirit feels itself pulled downward by desolation, far from the comfort of a starry sky. George's formulation of this point appears in his first cycle of poems entitled Hymns. Quote, oh, do not hear that alluring cry, and do not say that your suffering is your guide, and do not change an honorable garment. The garment is the poet pilgrim's garment of ascetic resistance. His guide is not his personal suffering. His stance does not arise from his personal shortcomings, but from an intuition of die wahren Auen, the fields where truth and genuineness, quote, clear springs and clear air might be found, but not here in the marketplace of the nation. This stance does not change, certainly not before 1906, when George writes in his preface to a volume of poems called Maximin, we went to meet a humanity frozen and disfigured. Rule and commandment were created by the masses. The poet's solitude is necessary, is desired. And then citing himself, I abandoned human happiness for your song and took the yoke of pilgrimage upon me. There's no writer of this period, always around 1905, not George or Rilke, not Musil or von Hofmannsthal, whose work is not saturated with the texts of the master German poet Goethe and the master German philosopher Nietzsche. Kafka wrote of Goethe's hold on the imagination of the writers of his generation. He's worth quoting. Quote, Goethe probably retards the development of the German language by the force of his writing. Even though prose style has often traveled away from him in the interim, still, in the end, as at present, this is about 1910, it returns to him with strengthened yearning and even adopts obsolete idioms found in Goethe, but otherwise without any particular connection with him, in order to rejoice in the completeness of its unlimited dependence. And it's precisely from Goethe's Faust drama that there resounds the most famous, the most plangent cry of man, the homeless. Faust cries out, "Bin ich der Flüchtling nicht, der Unbauste, der Unmensch, ohne Zweck und Ruhe? Am I not the fugitive, the refugee without a home? Inhuman, without goal or rest, as like the cataract, from rock to rock I foam, raging with passion toward the abyss." And Gretchen, at one side, with childlike blunt desires, inside her cottage on the alpine meadow, with all her homely joys and cares, her everything, within that little world, and I, whom the gods hate and mock, was not satisfied that I seized the lock and smashed the mountainside. Her peace I had to undermine. There's much to say about this passage, but before we proceed to Nietzsche's and Rilke's more contemporaneous version of these themes. These lines from Faust made so strong an impression on the German mind that the nation as a whole was forever inclined to see itself as a refugee nation. Quite particularly in these years before the Great War, it felt that it had been denied its rightful place under the sun. This feeling had been growing for half a century. Germany had no place on the earth, since France and Russia ruled the great land masses of Central Europe. And Germany was driven from the seas as well, which were ruled by Britannia. So what medium was left for the Germans to occupy, as Heine quipped, other than the air? The medium of fantasies and abstractions, of airy words and airy thoughts. This nation of Luftmenschen, of dreamers, of persons without grounding in reality. Note that here Heine cloaks the nation as a whole with the qualities of its poets. He was not entitled to do so. We know all too well the outcome of this national adventure toward mastery of the earth and the sea, the immitigable horrors of the two wars. And so it was then, just after the Second World War, when the term refugee in Faust's cry had an exact national and political meaning, that German writers returned once again to this Goethe passage. Hans Holthusen published a famous book describing, through works of Goethe and Rilke, the spiritual malaise of this confused and scattered nation, a book bearing this very title, Der unbehauste Mensch, the man without a home. Now, the title is apt because Holthusen's book takes note of the responsibility for this horror, I'm talking about the wars, of many of the previous generation coming of age in 1905. Just as the Goethe passage makes Faust's helter-skelter desperation the product of a particular crime, he's destroyed the life of another person, Margaret. And we'll note in this Faust passage the tempo of Faust's fall. He rushes headlong to his doom like a raging cataract, even here with the energy that is his characteristic. He does nothing if not violently. And so it's expectable that Faust will take from his despair a new and fierce energy to write poetry, yes, as he woos Helena in Germanic verses, and to act as well, to found a new community. His thrust is forward seeking, but many of these acts do violent harm. Now this is a text that was read by the poets of our time, by Nietzsche and by Rilke, as we'll see. In this light, consider now a poem of Nietzsche's found in his papers and published shortly after his death in 1900. Keep in mind that Nietzsche is, after Goethe, the spiritual father of the writers of 1905. And as a writer, he too absorbed Goethe profoundly, terming him a sort of Übermensch, a Renaissance spirit, and a Dionysian. This poem of Nietzsche's homelessness is titled Vereinsamt, cast into solitude. The crows caw and move in whirring flight to the city. Soon it will snow. Happy is he who yet has a home. Now you stand stiffly, gazing backwards, alas. For how long, why, you fool, did you steal away into the world's winter, the world a gate to a thousand wastelands, silent and cold. Whoever has lost what you have lost never stops anywhere. Now you stand pallid, cursing, cursed to winter wanderings, like the smoke that always seeks colder skies. Fly, bird, rasp out your song to the tune of a wasteland bird. Hide, you fool, your bleeding heart in ice and scorn. The crows caw and move in whirring flight to the city. Soon it will snow, woe betide he who has no home. The relationship to the Goethe passage is vivid. The theme is the same, the accursed wanderer without a home. And the wintry waste can suggest the icy heights above the meadow from which Faust falls. But point for point, the contrasts within these themes are striking. Faust's fall was situated against an alpine background containing one simple hut, Margaret's. Nietzsche's world contains the ambiguous lure of the populated city. Faust's desperation was understandable as the punishment for a crime. Nietzsche's crime remains unknown. It appears to be beyond psychological definition. It is not the evident result of an accident or trauma occurring in his psychic life, but the very condition of his existence. We could call this, with the philosopher Julia Kristeva, not his subject, but the abject in him, the grasped impossibility of harmonious satisfaction with his world. And there is again the tempo of the poem, which, unlike Goethe's, is monotonous. It is less an energetic cry than a shriek that rhymes with the squawking of the crows and does not take the speaker further. In fact, at the end of the poem, he literally returns to the images and figures of its beginning, with only the slightest change, the addition of the word not, he who does not have a home, the eternal recurrence of the same. Would it have helped Nietzsche, who stands behind this wanderer, to have taken his place as a productive citizen and house father in one of his nation's cities? Nietzsche himself warded off this surmise. On the manuscript of this very poem, he added this postscript, quote, "God spare us. This fellow thinks I long to get back into German warmth, into the stuffy bliss of the German living room. My friend, what frustrates me and holds me back is your kind of understanding. My pity for you. Pity for German crisscross understanding." He's defiant. And now we've arrived at Rilke's poem of 1902, closer to the year 1905, that concerns us. Lord, it is time. The summer was immense. Lay your shadow on the sundials and let loose the winds in the field. Bid the last fruits to be full. Give them another two more southerly days. Press them to ripeness and chase that last sweetness into the heavy wine. Whoever has no house now will not build one anymore. Whoever is alone now will remain so for a long time, will stay up, read, write long letters, and wander the avenues up and down restlessly while the leaves are blowing. The grief is more temperate, the language less militant. Vis-a-vis his masters Goethe and Nietzsche, Rilke seems at this stage a decadent, no doubt. For Nietzsche's iciest winter, read here mellow autumn. For the wasteland, read long avenues, suggesting the park-like suburbs of Paris or Munich. This poet is equipped with pen and paper. Nietzsche's tool was the hammer. Nietzsche wrote across the centuries. Rilke's persona will write his friends. But put these differences aside. In all these poems, we have to do with the poetry of homelessness. These writers do not lament the loss of another home once known. They do not remember or concretely envision another refuge. The poem is all the home they have. It is the container of this homelessness and none other. Their feelings are inscribed in the rhythms of the poem. Their isolation is inscribed in the solitude of the poem. The poem is the fact of their separation. Kafka considered literature, he said, as quite literally founding a homeland, yes, but, quote, on the moon. I'm quoting him. Quote, "When we write something, we've not tossed out the moon, den Mond ausgeworfen, whose origins might then be investigated. It's obscure, but I think it means the work is not some transcendent astral body whose source can be traced back to the poet's craving to produce such a brilliant visionary alternative to his lived experience. Rather, continues Kafka in its cryptic way, we have moved to the moon with everything that we have. The separation from the homeland has already taken place. The site of literature, its only homeland, is somewhere out of this domestic world. The separation has already taken place. This would be a good juncture at which to return to Lukács' description of the loss of an integrated world. I hope you agree. And the dubious gain of a problematic world. And indeed, Lukács' argument now does actually run the way Kafka's does. You'll recall that Lukács was speaking of philosophy as the urge to be at home everywhere. And that is why philosophy, he continues, which determines the form and supplies the content of literary creation, is always the symptom of the rift between inside and outside, a sign of the essential difference between the self and the world, the incongruence of soul and deed. That is why the happy ages have no philosophy, he says. For there's not yet any interiority, and there's not yet any exteriority, any otherness for the soul of the Greeks, of Baudelaire's dweller among nature's temples, goes out to seek adventure. It lives through adventures, but it does not know the real torment of seeking and the real danger of finding. Such a soul never risks itself. It does not yet know that it can lose itself. It never thinks of having to look for itself. Such an age is the age of the epic, while ours, concludes Lukács, is the age of the novel, and I add, in privileged instances of the lyric poem. We'll now cite a final passage from Lukács, every word of which could provoke a commentary. Quote, we have invented the productivity of the spirit. That is why the archaic images, the gods, the persons who populate myths, that is why the archaic images have irrevocably lost their objective self-evidence for us, and our thinking follows the endless path of an approximation that is never fully accomplished. We have invented the creation of forms, and that is why everything that falls from our weary and despairing hands must always be incomplete. We have found the only true substance within ourselves. That is why we have to place an unbridgeable chasm between cognition, between knowledge and action, between soul and created structure, between self and world. Why all substantiality has to be dispersed in reflexivity on the far side of that chasm. That is why our essence had to become a postulate for ourselves and thus create a still deeper, still more menacing abyss between our own selves. A famous set passage in Thomas Mann's Buddenbrook's novel of 1901 will take up a motif from the Lukács passage, where Lukács speaks of our weary and despairing hands. The passage in Buddenbrook's is a novelistic example of this topic of separation, though obviously enfeebled when put next to Nietzsche's account of it. Mann's novel is entitled The Verfall of a Family, and this word Verfall put my online German-English dictionary into a frenzy of lexical excitement. Normally, when you type in a German word, you get an English word. Type in Dichter, and you get poet. And that's the whole reply. But type in Verfall, decadence, and you get an appropriately decadent, excessively nervous superfluity of meanings. Thus, abasement, hence Buddenbrook's The Abasement of a Family. But also it's break up, break down, decadence, decay, declination, decline, deterioration, dilapidation, disintegration, disrepair, expiration, expiry, forfeiture, lapse, maturity, termination by lapse of time. I think we get the message. In Mann's view, an integrated family has turned into a gravely problematical one. The text I have in mind from Buddenbrook's is that great set piece in which the older Thomas Buddenbrook's addresses his sister Toni while meditating on the kind of modern decadent, the artist type, who prefers the ocean to the mountains. What sort of man is it who would prefer the monotony of the ocean? It seems to me it would be someone who for too long has gazed into the perplexities of inward things, so as to demand from outward things one thing above all, simplicity, oneness. It's the least of things to climb about bravely on the mountains, while beside the sea one sits quietly on the sand. But I know the look in the eyes with which one does honor to the one thing, mountains, and the look with which one does honor to the other, the sea. The first, sure, defiant, happy eyes, full of the lust for adventure, steadfast, with the courage that comes from life. These range from peak to peak. But upon the vastness of the sea, which, with this mystic and paralyzing fatalism, sends its waves surging, their dreams a veiled, hopeless, and knowing glance, which somewhere, sometime, gaze deeply into tragic perplexities. Health and sickness, that is the difference. The one clambers boldly into the marvelous multiplicity of the cleft, jagged, towering apparitions to test one's life force, of which nothing yet has been expended, but the other one dwells on the immense simplicity of outward things, so weary is he from the entanglements of inner things. Now, this is a view of poetic indifference seen from the angle of the allegedly Nietzschean healthy man, who has no need of the tensions of a higher alienation from life. Mann here comments on both types standing above the figure of Thomas from what one writer has called in another context the stance of someone urbanely skeptical and critical of the modern pursuit of disenchantment. But now consider Nietzsche himself, who is very much stronger than Mann, on what can be done with the sickness, real or alleged, said to cause the problematical cast of mind. In Nietzsche, sickness stimulates resistance. It calls for transformation. Quote, "We must constantly give birth to our thoughts out of our pain and nurture them with everything we have in us of blood, heart, fire, pleasure, passion, agony, conscience, fate, and catastrophe." That goes into our thoughts. Life to us, that means constantly transforming everything we are into light and flame, as well everything that happens to us. Now, this is grand. And yet the perplexities of the inner life, life lived as what Lukács called a postulate, even when turned to light and flame, cannot become the foundation of a life. One cannot live as a postulate. And even assuming one can unfold that postulate that one is and give it literary form, one cannot be at home inside even a perfect poem on homelessness. To live this far from the hearth is to be a monster, an ungeheuer, from the Latin infamiliaris. To live this far from the starry sky is to be a vermin, an ungeziefer, from Middle High German, ungezieferer, a creature unacceptable for sacrifice. These are allusions to a story by Kafka called The Metamorphosis. You could die of the cold, recall the Nietzsche of the poem Vereinsamt, cast into solitude. So within this sphere of alienation, within what Lukács calls the rift, writers introduce another economy, an order into the house of alienation. And as befits our major concern at this Einstein Fest, they turn to science for a start. If I present some of their solutions, these are really only descriptions of adventures of thought in the direction of solutions, what Lukács called approximations. And so we should not be surprised if here too, the only result of the adventure is its own narration. Poets and writers are not so separate from the ruling phenomena of their age that they will not attempt to turn them to their own ends. Modernism takes in selected atoms of the modern experience. And this age, circa 1905, supplies to its poets, yes, scientific frames in which to cast their sense of dislocation. as a sense of place gives way to space. Enter the topic of physics and mathematics, and I'll add bookkeeping, all with the aim of bearing witness to the life of the rift. Let's say a word first to bookkeeping, since it is the oddest bit of science in the list. Though it is a fairly simple mathematics, it has been from its inception on pregnant with a future. Here we can cite the novelist Hermann Broch. The centerpiece of his great trilogy, Die Schlafwandler, The Sleepwalkers, the centerpiece is the so-called second novel. That second novel is entitled 1903, Esch or Anarchy. Esch is a character's name. This Esch is a bookkeeper by trade, and later in this problematical work, the trilogy, in what is called an historical excursus on the disintegration of values, Broch writes, "The two great rational ways of understanding the world in modernity are the language of science in mathematics and the language of money in bookkeeping." With his novel, Broch wants to say that the mentality of bookkeeping is not confined to the back rooms of offices, but penetrates the spirit of the age. And since poets and writers, as we know from Musil, are bent on bending and exposing traditional, established, and dependable psychological attitudes en route to puncturing them, poets and writers will turn to even such rational ways of understanding the world as bookkeeping, will turn to them and turn that thing, bookkeeping, to their own artistic purposes. In Broch's novel, bookkeeping surfaces as both a topic in the plot and as a model of ethical thinking. This August Esch hero is a bookkeeper who gets fired on registering that his boss has been cooking the books. A hero of conscience, though a lamed one, Esch is furious at the deceit but cannot manage to report the crime. In the course of his wandering, he visits a variety show where an inarticulate, put-upon woman allows knives to be thrown at her. Her virtual martyrdom makes a lasting impression on him. Next, Esch visits a political rally, which leads to a trumped-up charge made against a friend of his, Martin, a meek socialist agitator who goes to jail for it. This injustice rankles in Esch. It upsets, writes Broch, quote, the solid and legitimate bookkeeping of his soul, and again, the upright bookkeeping of his soul. Thereafter, Esch visits a Salvation Army rally where he is struck by talk of redemption, Erlösung. From this point on, the novel consists of long, tortured meditations on Esch's part on how to square the world's accounts, either by some form of self-inflicted martyrdom, conforming to a logic of sacrifice, and thus including marriage, or by a punishment of the guilty party, part of a more nearly rational settling of accounts. The tangled plot could lead one to conclude, along with Esch, that accounts have indeed been settled. Esch gets married. But the novel actually ends thus, quote, he realized that it was purely coincidental if the addition of the columns tallied. Broch was himself groomed to manage a large textile factory before he fell into the rift of novel writing. So it might be that writing about bookkeeping was simply a reflex of his experience. Is this mention exceptional? Was bookkeeping then so much in the air circa 1905 that poets could not resist it, even as a trope? Here's a striking passage once again from Rilke's extraordinary novel, The Notebooks of Malte Lorenz-Brügge, which I gladly employ as an encyclopedia of the advanced forms of artistic consciousness of this time. Rilke literally uses the diction of bookkeeping to contend that, unlike the few facts genuinely at our disposal, our conjectures, Vermutungen, and insights, Einsichten, are only subsequently, nachträglich, added on to empirical experience. They are more supplements, they are mere supplements, supplied only afterwards as something, quote, belated, as payment in arrears. It's the relation of a fact, empirical fact, and interpretation, speculation, understanding, cast in the model of a bookkeeper's ledger. Like entries in a ledger, these facts, I'm so sorry, like entries in a ledger, these interpretations, conjectures, and insights are registered after the factual experience of what they are about. They are there to settle accounts, balance sheets, Abschluss, nothing more. Right afterward, Rilke continues, a new page begins with a completely different account and no total carry forward. Meaning, presumably, that when the facts of the case, the things in our life, are again encountered, they are encountered as if for the first time. Facts and insights cannot be joined together. They do not tally. Thought yields no appreciable profit. The diction of bookkeeping is turned to poetic ends to establish the hermetic, closed-off character of the inner life of insights and, and conjectures. We find another, more advanced sort of bookkeeping at this time in another equally unexpected place. In André Gide's Nietzschean novel of 1902, The Immoralist, the hero Michel, the immoralist, defiant of the conventions that limit passion to marriage, composes with scientific precision the formula for a new ethics. During weeks of amazement at the temperate richness of the Normandy countryside, he lets himself go, quote, in a dream of lands where every force should be so regulated, all expenditures so compensated, all exchanges so strict that the slightest waste would be appreciable. Whereupon Michel applies, says Gide, his dream to life, imagining a code of ethics that should institute the scientific and perfect utilization of a man's self by his controlling intelligence. Michel dreams that a controlled expenditure of the desire for aesthetic and erotic pleasure could amount to an ethics. Features of this dream will interest our modern writers, but only as a dream to be dismantled, since they'll wonder how good the fit is between an ethics centering on loyalty to the discipline of their art and a calculated use of the drives to sex and the feeling of power. And so does Gide's novel wonder. Here is the climax of Michel's system. He is exhausted, wasted. Look, I have here a number of white pebbles. I let them soak in the shade, then hold them in the hollow of my hand and wait until their soothing coolness is exhausted. Then I begin once more. changing the pebbles and putting back those that have lost their coolness to soak in the shade again. Time passes and the evening comes on. L'Immoralist examines this connection of ideas and concludes with a travesty of calculation. Calculation persists, but the dream of perfect bookkeeping ends in a nightmare. White stones here, dark stones there, and then they are reversed. This image condenses all that is left of an experiment in computing pleasure and passion as an ethical code. Nietzsche, who, as I said, saturates this novel of Gide's, The Immoralist, and Rilke's, and almost every other piece of important writing in pre-war Munich, Berlin, Vienna, and Paris, addressed the dilemma, this dilemma, of the problematic writer and his passions in On the Genealogy of Morals. Remember, the idea in Gide is that a calculated, computed expenditure of passion would suit the writer, the problematical self. Nietzsche says, one should be on guard against a confusion, he writes, into which an artist himself all too easily falls out of psychological contiguity, to put it as the English do explain, as if he himself were what he is able to depict, think up, express. In fact, the situation is such that if he were precisely that, he would certainly not depict, think up, express it. A Homer would not have written an Achilles, nor Goethe a Faust, if Homer had been an Achilles, or if Goethe had been a Faust. A perfect and whole artist is separated to all eternity from the real, the actual. On the other hand, one understands how he can at times become tired to the point of despair of this eternal irreality and falseness of his innermost existence, and that he makes the attempt to encroach for once upon what is most forbidden precisely to him, upon what is real, make the attempt truly to be, passionately to be. With what success? One can guess. No, Xi took all the guesswork out of it in 1902. That immoralist, the artist who would live, ends very badly. References to science and mathematics abound in the literature of this time, and I shall conclude very soon. In Robert Musil's 1906 novel, The Perplexities of Young Turles, the idea of imaginary numbers, the square root of minus one, is introduced to highlight the irrationality of the current world picture. He cannot grasp this idea. And especially for Turles, its lack of moral foundations. In Rilke's Malte-Lorenz-Brügge, physical problems, such as calculating the apparently irrational behavior of a moving object, here the rolling lid of a tin can, plays a similar role in highlighting the unintelligibility of the normal. In this novel, too, we are shown Nikolai Kuzmich's attempt to save time by doing everything double time. This experiment with time units fails, alas, since at the end of the week, Kuzmich has absolutely no saved time to show for himself. It's still merely the end of the week. Paradoxes are conjured in the language of science in these novels. And inversely, the world of physical objects, the domain of science, is distracted by human perplexities. Here it is very evident, concludes Rilke's Malte-Lorenz-Brügge, quote, how much confusion has been caused among things by their association with humans. The historian of modernism, Peter Conrad, noted that, quote, Musil had proudly claimed that the novel had a duty shared with no other art form to, quote, incorporate the intellectual content of an age. In modern times, Conrad cites Musil as saying, science lay at the edge of intellectual daring. This meant, as Musil argued in 1912, that a novelist must seek instruction from Einstein and Minkowski. The theories of physicists were not merely intellectual conundrums. Relativity introduced a new set of practical problems to daily life as people exerted themselves to cope with the varying tempi of existence. But I think it was not so much relativity that introduced this set of practical problems as what our writers have been calling industrialization and the interruption. In this talk, I've been less concerned with the experience people had of the varying tempi of existence and the way these tempi were registered differently by poets and writers. And now I shall all but conclude with a stellar example from Kafka's diaries. The clocks do not agree. The inner one races in a devilish or demonic, or at any rate, inhuman way. The outer one goes haltingly at its usual pace. What else can happen except that the two different worlds come apart, and they do come apart, or at least tear at each other in a dreadful way? There may be various reasons for the wildness of the inner process. The most visible one is introspection, which will not allow any idea to come to rest, but chases each one upwards, itself become an idea again, to be chased further by renewed introspection. Secondly, this chasing, he continues, takes the direction that leads away from mankind. The solitude that for the most part has all along been forced on me, in part was voluntarily sought by me, but what was this too if not compulsion? This solitude is now becoming completely unambiguous and is heading for the extreme. Where is it leading? The most compelling thought seems to be that it can lead to insanity. Nothing further can be said about it. The chase goes through me and tears me to bits. Or, however, I can I, bear up, if only for the most minute part, hence allow myself to be carried along by the chase. To what place, then, do I come? Chase, hunt, is after all only a metaphor. I can also say assault on the last earthly boundary, and indeed an assault from below, from mankind. And since below mankind. And since this too is only a metaphor, I can replace it by the metaphor of an assault from above down to me. Kafka links the frenzy of reflection and introspection to a condition of pain and sacrifice, but one larger than that of any ordinary human being, considering this rage to reflect as the metaphor of an assault from above. This is an extraordinary text on relativity, an example of an imaginative transformation of the variations in tempo heightened by modernization, in line with Baudelaire's dictum, the whole visible universe is nothing but a storehouse of images and signs for the imagination to digest and transform. In 1905, many of these images and signs do originate from a world of scientific preoccupations. They are then transformed by our poets, but the transformation does not heal the rift, it articulates it differently. My final remark addresses the attraction of doing science in the imaginative world of modernist writers. From the rift, science is contemplated in fiction, both as a topic and as a method, less as truth than as a literary opportunity. I've stressed the use of a discourse of bookkeeping as a kind of scientific management of the inner life and a model for an ethics in Gide's The Immoralist. This discourse could point to a higher order science, of which writers like Mann, Rilke, Musil, and Bloch were well aware, and which, on a larger scale, could bring the anarchy and confusion of modern experience into equilibrated wholes. Such science could serve as a model to organize a modernist style for many such works, like Rilke's Montelorenzbrücke, like Bloch's Sleepwalkers, need to balance tense clusters of fragmentary sensations, with reflections on these sensations, with citations from other books and other disparate materials. Science, which for the moment I call higher order bookkeeping, strives to regulate a world of disparate sensory manifolds in conflict, a meta-world, in the words of Richard Shepherd, quote, of decentered, multi-dimensionally fluctuating energies involving leaps, jerks, gaps, irregularities, and discontinuities, threatening to run out of control. If some modernist works incorporate the fragment, the leap, the broken line, then a literary scientific bookkeeping might produce a higher order balance sheet, tracking and regulating such disparate items before all turns into a confusion of words. The writer could strive to enter fragments of experience into the ledgers of the imagination according to the logic of equivalence, where debit balances credit and profit balances loss. Science, too, works with such a logic of equivalence to produce explanatory models of even such disparate things as flows of time. But the literary adventure of submitting an imaginative grasp of the world to science appears in 1905 to re-inscribe but not to heal the rift. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much, Stanley. We have time for a few questions, if there are any from the audience. We have microphones on both aisles. If you'd like to ask a question, if you'd like to raise your hand, we'll bring you a microphone. So take her up there.
Thank you very much for the lecture. It was quite interesting. I have a question regarding if you are aware of other artists that made reference to the universe. You mentioned about Baudelaire, you know?
Homer? I'm sorry. Could you just repeat the last phrase?
Artistic writings that mention the universe. You mentioned about Baudelaire, that he made some comments about the universe, the nature of the universe.
I'm so sorry, I didn't understand which writer you named.
Baudelaire?
Oh, Baudelaire, forgive me, thank you.
Yeah. The reason I'm asking is that I'm originally from Romania, and it was a poet, the greatest Romanian poet, Mihai Eminescu, who has a poetry about the nature of the universe and so on. So just I was thinking if you can make a parallel commentary about this.
But of course, you'd probably want to oppose the term universe to the term rift or divide, right? Or abyss or chasm, which words do reappear in the poets I've chosen to discuss. They're not in a position to give a description of the universe, which implies one whole world, but rather describe a problematical condition of feeling quite separated from the whole. The only wholeness that they claim to pursue, to want to pursue, is the questionable wholeness of the work of art, which cannot also be easily made round, cannot be easily made complete. As I say this, I remember that Rilke spoke of the trouble he had in making his book, Matador's Brügge, vollzählig. That would be a useful word for our discussion, our discourse at the perimeter, as giving a full account, as produce the book would not be complete, the book would not be whole, all the fissures and contradictions in the thought of his main character remain unresolved at the close. It ends on a kind of ellipsis of words. He was still searching. Right? So you don't so much have the feeling of that a universe has been established, but a multiverse, meta-world, a decentered energy, fragments, breakages. That was the mood. And that's why Musil could, in such atrocious fashion, welcome the coming of the war. It's a great unifying principle. Now, once again, we enjoy simplicity.
Okay, we'll take one more question over here, please.
I just wanted to ask, when you were introduced, there was mentioned that you are working on something to do with the problems of translation in regards to comparative literature, and that's actually my area as an MA candidate. I'm working on German translations and adaptations of Wilde's work, and I was really just curious about that because, of course, translation is always problematic, but I was wondering what your particular view was on it.
There was recently a kind of crisis in the field of comparative literature, recently and ongoing. There was a time when comparative literature knew just what it was doing. It was reading the theorists of Paris. It's reading Foucault and Lacan and Derrida, when these writers had not yet entered the curricula of the study of national literatures. But then they all got translated, and so you can study every one of these writers in English departments. So then Complet had to think of another way to define its project. It was not so much bringing in theory from Europe as thinking that Complet would somehow translate, mediate and translate foreign works. But translate in some non-literal sense. This was my objection to using the word translate as defining the way in which Complet is supposed to bring different literatures to bear on one another. If you can translate, then you're not doing comparative literature. If you hold, all right, if you put together a text of Flaubert, springs to mind, and a text of Kafka, and let's say you can read the Flaubert in French and you can read the Kafka in German, and you hold them together in your mind, you're not doing any sort of translation in the literal sense, are you? You're not translating them into English in order to... You somehow understand what Flaubert said and what Kafka said, and you know how to put them together, but you're thinking in a medium which is not English, it's somehow between the languages. That's why I meant that translation was not a good model for doing comparative literature. Comparative literature should have focused on the somewhat mysterious process of how it is that we can understand and relate works in different languages simultaneously.
Okay, we'll do one more, sure. Microphone right here, please.
Thank you. You spoke about quite a bit about the rift. And obviously, later in the 20th century, that rift opened considerably in literature in Europe. Is that something that has continued past, that have we progressed past the rift at all? And if so, where has that gone?
There's never any shortage of rifts, is there? We don't lack for them. I suppose the difference really is the tone in which questions of separation and disaffection and disenchantment are addressed. This tone is one of high seriousness, and it is the rift, a sense of solitude, as an opportunity. It is an opportunity to. This will vary with different writers, but in Nietzsche, to disclose the deep granitic self, it's a process that can't even be defined quite by the object it produces, because it is so serious, it is the condition of living itself. I'm wanting to describe for a moment the mood around 1905 or 10. The French writer Barthes formulated a brilliant aphorism saying that for the writers he had in mind, to write was an intransitive verb. It has no object. As you sleep, as you breathe, as you live, so you write. Kafka has the phrase, it's really a word, Schriftsteller sein, one nominative, one noun. His being is writerly being. He lives as a writer. The sense of being separated from what he calls the life of the generations defines that, the rift. To write is also to put oneself outside the life of the generations, the chain of the generations, he says. For what purpose? Well, you saw from that last quote, he doesn't know where this journey is taking him, but it is a journey he has to take. He said it was a compulsion, it was necessary. We just don't have that tone of high seriousness associated with postmodern experiments that tend to be playful, that are disenchanted with disenchantment. That perhaps it's that urbane and skeptical tone that says, we had it. We've had the suffering artist wanting to produce a quasi-totality, a totality of negation, a full account. We've had the artist who wants to bear complete witness to his sense of isolation and separation, right? Give a fullest phenomenology of solitude. I haven't met many people who want to do that anymore. at least not on the plane. Sorry. Just a different tone, I think. Do we feel alienated? Well, obviously, that's a very interesting issue and would involve, of course, the way the media have become so attractive and become part of ourselves, so that when we speak of memory, we're usually talking about a computational aspect of the PC we have on our desk. Huh? What do you mean, memory? Memory. I've got a lot of memory. I can remember a lot of things. Got over 3,000 gigabytes of it. And knowledge, well, why do I need knowledge if I have Google? And it's probably true. I'm sure you live very intensely. Professors tend to be associated with their machines these days. There's a lot going on the web. It's very interesting. It's all there. Soon, the libraries will all be digitized. They're already important forays into this field. There's a website called Questia, in which entire libraries of secondary literature are available to be cut and pasted, to put into your journal. It's just the divide. Yes, the rift is closed. If you got 400 million.
Good. On that note, I would like to thank Stanley Korngold very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bluesman Mel Brown is in the Black Hole Bistro tonight, Friday and Saturday nights during Einstein Fest, blues and jazz. You're welcome to join us on the fourth floor, up the stairs that way, or up the elevator over there to the Black Hole Bistro. Thanks again for joining us. Good night.